Welcome. This is the second of two lectures, which serve as an introduction to the culture of healthcare and healthcare professionals. The two lectures are meant as an introductory unit for a full course on the culture of healthcare, covering the people who work in healthcare, the settings in which healthcare is delivered, the practices and processes of healthcare delivery, some of the professional values, beliefs, and ethics which drive that behavior, and how health information technologies interact with healthcare professionals in their work. In the first lecture, we discussed what is meant by the word culture in reference to healthcare and healthcare professionals. In the second lecture, we will discuss why this is important and how we can learn more about it. Now, the first question is, why should we learn more about the culture of healthcare and healthcare professionals? To get some insight into this question, we asked people who were trained in biomedical informatics and have been working in the field for between 1 and 10 years. First, we asked them, what do you think is the most important thing for non-health professionals to understand about clinical practice? Here are some representative answers. One respondent said, how clinical practices operate, the bureaucratic, political, and hierarchical structures of the organization, and the way people are expected to relate to each other. Another said, if I am designing or implementing a system, it's imperative that I spend time in every setting I can to get a feel for what each clinician does in the course of his or her day. A third said, only by understanding what the clinician experience is can you meet technology needs. Another response was, they need to understand the user, how they work, how they think, what their challenges and frustrations are, and how you can help them. Another typical response was, having an understanding of the basic roles, responsibilities, approaches, and workflows of the members of the healthcare team. We also asked informatics professionals who have been working in the field for between 1 and 10 years, do you have any other comments or suggestions about teaching non-health professionals to work with health information technology in clinical settings? Some representative answers include, expose students to a variety of settings. Push students to probe more deeply when getting feedback from clinicians. Teamwork, not just between you and clinicians, but the whole healthcare team, including administration, vendors, patients, researchers, etc. You just might be the piece that pulls or holds everyone together. Always shadow the intended user many times before attempting an HIT intervention. Give them as much exposure as possible to a variety of clinicians and clinical settings to remove some of the mystery. Suggest that they volunteer. Not so much on the clinical level, but staff, administration, and patients and visitors. In my field, most jobs want experience in certain applications. It was helpful to at least see how these work. It seems evident that, at least if you ask health informatics professionals who have been working in the field in healthcare settings, industry, and so forth, learning more about the culture of healthcare is important to being effective in biomedical and health informatics. If it is important that we learn more about the culture of healthcare, how can we do this? This slide suggests at least one part of the answer. Get out in the field and see what the natives are doing. The photograph shows two classic anthropologists, Margaret Mead and Gregory Bateson, seated at a small table in a hut on an island in the South Pacific. They have gone into the field to observe the South Pacific Islanders and to try to understand their culture. In the photograph, the two anthropologists are hard at work making notes about the day's observations using what was then the latest technology, an 8mm movie camera and old-school typewriters. This classic view of anthropology is a starting point, but needs an update. The obvious update to the image of anthropologists doing fieldwork in the South Pacific is that we are talking about observing cultures that are more modern, closer to home, and more similar to our own. The less obvious update is an update to the concept of culture itself. This slide presents a view of culture presented in the first introductory lecture. Culture refers to integrated patterns of human behavior that include the language, thoughts, communications, actions, customs, beliefs, values, and institutions of racial, ethnic, religion, or social groups. This is the definition provided by the United States Department of Health and Human Services Office of Minority Health. In the first lecture, we modified this to describe healthcare culture as the language, thought processes, styles of communication, customs, beliefs, institutions that characterize the profession of nurses, doctors, allied health workers, or clinical managers, etc. And we noted that these elements of culture are learned, in part, through participation in the customs, rituals, and rules of conduct, which are often not formal or explicit. This concept of culture, however, is no longer appropriate. The classical concept of culture was developed by expanding Western civilizations as they came into contact with physically isolated groups of people and tried to understand them. This concept presumes that the observer's culture is normal or normative and defines the behaviors and practices of those being observed as different. It is generally taken to mean a static, closed, coherent system of meaning and action, in which an individual only and always participates. This presumes that a person belongs to one culture, always belongs to that culture, and exhibits its features. But when you consider our contemporary world with global communication, transportation, and migration connecting virtually every region with every other, culture is no longer closed. It is no longer single. It is no longer constant or static. According to Michael Agar, culture is instead relative. That is to say, any description of a given culture is grounded in the language and culture of the observer. Agar calls this lingua culture. We do not have to adopt this term, but we can understand the idea that a description of a particular culture can only be created in the context of the person observing it, grounded in that person's language and culture. Another person from another culture speaking another language might well describe the observed culture in a different way. Further, the description of a given culture depends on the people observed and on the person observing. Therefore, we do not produce a description of a culture, but rather we produce a description of the difference between two cultures. For example, the Northwest culture of Portland or Seattle, compared to the Gulf Coast culture of Louisiana or Mississippi. This is analogous to the notion of velocity in physics. The velocity of a body in motion is always relative to some reference point or other body, not absolute. An airplane has one velocity when compared to air around it, airspeed, another velocity when compared to the ground, and in reality its ground speed is different depending on whether the plane is going east or west. Culture, like velocity, is always relative. Any description of a culture can only exist in reference to some other culture, usually one's own. Another aspect of a modern concept of culture is that it is always plural and always partial. Few of us belong to a single cultural group. For any particular type of person, group, or situation, there is usually more than one culture in play. No single cultural traditional reference can define or explain behaviors or interactions. Consider a middle-aged nurse from Texas who may participate in a particular religion, whose background may include particular educational or other experiences. The behavior of this nurse is unlikely to be completely explained by any one of these cultural elements. Some behavior may be a reflection of the professional culture of nurses. Some behavior may be a reflection of a Texas upbringing. Some behavior may be a reflection of an MBA or experience as an engineer or whatever. The point is, to paraphrase Michael Agar, culture is always plural and always partial. Think about how this might relate to understanding culture in healthcare settings, where so many different professional, organizational, and other cultures interact on a day-to-day basis. We will now turn our attention to ethnography. Ethnography is the anthropologist's practice and description of what life is like in any local world or a specific setting in a specific society, usually one different from that of the anthropologist. Classically, an ethnographer visits a foreign place, learns the language, and systematically describes the social patterns in a particular village, neighborhood, or network. Critical to this work is the great importance placed on understanding the native's point of view. Understanding how the behaviors, practices, and language make sense to the natives themselves, as opposed to what they mean to the outsider doing the observation. Ethnography emphasizes engagement with people and with the practices they undertake in their local worlds. To understand the culture or cultures of healthcare, we can adopt the approach of an ethnographer trying to understand language, behaviors, and practices in terms of what they mean to the natives, in this case, the nurses, doctors, therapists, clinic managers, and others who make up a modern complex healthcare system. Important insights into other culture or differences between two cultures are gained when we pay attention to what Agar calls rich points. Rich points are the behaviors that highlight cultural differences. Consider, for example, the language used to describe the persons we deal with, which we referred to previously. A person may be referred to by doctors as patient, by counselors and therapists as client, by the business office as customer, by the medical librarian as patron, and by the IT department as user. The differences in language suggest differences in the assumptions about the status of individuals, their goals, their relationship, and so forth. Sometimes terms which may seem neutral in one context or from a particular cultural reference point may be positive or negative when taken from another cultural perspective. An example is the conventional use of the term chief complaint by physicians. To physicians, this is an entirely neutral term, which refers to the symptoms or condition that brought the patient to see the doctor, the problem which the patient would like solved. But, to others, the word complaint may connote a more negative implication, that the person is complaining or whining. Not long ago, a physician was doing a sabbatical in informatics and worked within the office setting of an informatics department. He brought with him the assumptions and behaviors of his profession. For example, if his pager went off or he needed to make a phone call for some other reason, he would reach for the nearest phone, usually a phone in someone's cubicle belonging to a specific person, and make his call. For workers in this office setting, this behavior was completely unacceptable, since in this setting, a telephone belongs to a given individual, and it's not okay for anyone else to walk up and use it without asking. But this is a rich point, which can give us insight into differences between the cultures. On a hospital ward, most of the equipment belongs to no one in particular and is available to everyone. It is normal behavior to pick up the nearest phone if no one is using it to make a call. For this physician, bringing his usual behavior based on hospital beliefs and assumptions into the office setting resulted in a conflict with the normal beliefs and assumptions of his new setting. This is an example of a rich point, a behavior that highlights cultural differences. In this case, the assumption in an office setting that pieces of equipment belong to or are assigned to specific individuals, compared to the assumption in a hospital setting that most pieces of equipment belong to no one in particular and are shared by all. The same difference in assumptions can occur when health information technology, or HIT, implementations in the hospital bring with them office-based assumptions about assignment and ownership. In an office setting, computers are often assigned to specific individuals and owned by them, an assumption which may be enforced in the way that each machine is configured for a specific individual. This assumption does not translate well into the hospital setting, where individuals move from ward to ward, from desk to desk, from computer to computer, and all computers must essentially serve all individuals. Configuration for a specific individual simply breaks down. The point here is that much can be learned by chasing these rich points. By exposing ourselves to other cultures, usually through fieldwork or site visits, we notice these rich points or differences in behavior that seem to make no sense, given our own cultural assumptions and values. The job, then, is to chase these rich points and translate the meaning from one culture to another. Culture, then, is not a property of them or of us, but rather a translation between the two. And it is never a complete translation. It is always partial. This applies to traditional cultural translation, such as translating from traditional healing practices to modern Western biomedicine. It can also apply to professional cultural translation, such as translating from the culture of health professionals to that of information technology or IT professionals. At times, there may be resistance to the idea of achieving or studying cultural competence. Whether we are talking about health professionals learning cultural competence for their dealings with patients, or we are talking about health informatics professionals learning cultural competence for their dealings in the healthcare system. When medical students encounter the cultural competence curriculum, we sometimes encounter this resistance expressed in a statement such as, "I didn't come to medical school to learn this," and, "We have more important things to worry about." This resistance also comes from a certain degree of ethnocentrism, or denial of one's own culture or cultural bias. It also comes from stereotyping and oversimplifying the cultures of others, failing to recall that culture is not monolithic, but relative, plural, and partial, as discussed earlier. Finally, it comes from othering. That is, treating persons in another group that is different from one's own group, which is taken to be normal, and then labeling, marginalizing, or excluding those in the other culture. In healthcare, we sometimes encounter these forms of resistance. In health informatics, we can also encounter the same forms of resistance, the idea that we have more important things to worry about in our informatics training. The ethnocentrism or cultural bias that grounds us in our own culture. The tendency to stereotype and oversimplify members of other cultures, for example, health professionals, and the tendency toward othering by defining people who are different, nurses, doctors, therapists, etc., and labeling, marginalizing, or excluding them. Perhaps you have seen examples of this in the organizations in which you have worked. Let's assume that you are convinced that the study of healthcare culture is important to successful development, implementation, and maintenance of health information technology for patients and clinicians. How can you learn more? Where should you look? You are likely to learn more by observing the people in healthcare, the places where they work, their work processes and practices, their values and beliefs, and their interactions with technologies, including not just computer technology, but other technologies as well. When considering the people, you should include not only health professionals, but everyone else that participates in the healthcare processes. Places where healthcare takes place are varied from modern tertiary academic medical centers to small primary care and community clinics to long-term care settings such as nursing homes and, of course, patients' own homes. When studying these processes and practices, it is not only important to characterize what people do, workflow, but also to understand why they do things in ways that they do them. Understanding values requires not only examination of explicit written and spoken values, but also values that seem to be implicit or that can be inferred from behavior, especially when conflicts arise. Finally, there is much to be learned from examining the interaction of people in the healthcare system with the technologies that help them do their work. As Ed Hutchins has said, "You cannot understand the task until you understand the tools." In learning more about the culture of healthcare, it is important that we keep our cultural assumptions from hindering practical understanding. Remember that modern anthropology rejects the idea of isolated societies with fixed sets of beliefs. There is no single culture of biomedicine. Rather, the culture of healthcare is the interaction and intersection of many diverse professional, organizational, and other cultures. We need to avoid stereotyping, assuming that individuals always and only exhibit behaviors of a single monolithic culture. because this may get in the way of solving the problem. We can translate these ideas from cultural competency to the interaction between health information technology and health informatics and health professionals, rejecting the idea of an isolated society with a set of beliefs. This helps us focus on issues rather than cultural stereotypes, whether they are stereotypes about professional culture or otherwise. To wrap up, we can consider several examples of the type of field studies we have been discussing that have been used in biomedical informatics. This work dates back at least to early ethnographic studies of work practices, which inform the design of computer workstations, such as the work of Danielle Fafchamp and the late Diana Forsyth. The American Medical Informatics Association gives an annual Diana Forsyth Award to the best studies of this type at its annual meeting. Other examples include studies of collaborative sense-making and information use in critical care and emergency care, such as those cited here by Forsyth, Ho, and Paul. Many studies of barcode medication technology have looked at its impact and side effects based on how it is actually used in the field, notably the work of Emily Patterson. Similarly, informal information sharing in critical care settings was described by Nancy Volkovich, the impact of computer order entry systems on doctor-nurse cooperation and cognition was examined by Marie Catherine Bosgaard Zephyr, and physician-patient interaction using exam room computers was studied using video ethnography by Vil Ventra and colleagues. These are just a few examples of the ways in which ethnographic approaches to the study of health professionals and their work practices have led to insights about the design and use of health information technology in healthcare settings. To summarize, let's enumerate some take-home points. First, effective health information technology requires understanding of the healthcare culture, including clinical settings, processes, and people. Second, a modern concept of culture is that it is always plural, always partial, and always relative, depending both on the observer and the observed. Third, rich points are behaviors or differences in behavior that give us insight into cultural differences and the why of work practices, including workarounds. Fourth, cultural competence is as important for health informatics as it is for health professionals, avoiding stereotypes, ethnocentrism, and othering. Finally, rich insights obtained from this kind of study can inform the design and evaluation of health information technology for clinical settings.